Yeah, I was just thinking about Summerland, and of course, you know that we're from Smokanogan. And I have one dear saintly lady who was a part of my congregation for, I don't know, at least 15 years, I would think, who was in the Summerland care home. And her kids also live in Summerland, but they had gone up to Kelowna for the day before the evacuation came. And they have no idea where Mother ended up. And so, all the things that happened during those times, 20,000 people displaced. Wow. Yeah, Lord, I add my prayers there too, Lord. May your grace and mercy enfold them. Well, how do you prepare yourself for when you get into a new and perhaps strange, perhaps even hostile environment? Take, for example, you know, you come to start a new job or a new role at work, and this comes with the challenges of fellow employees who have known the duties longer, and perhaps a boss who wishes you actually came with 10 years of experience doing the very job that he actually hired you for. And now he knows full well that you had never done anything like this in your life. But he still wishes you had all that experience and of course would get on to it, but he doesn't have time to train you at all. Have you been there? Oh, man. And he lets you know that before your very first shift. You haven't been there before, so everything is new. Fear starts racing through your mind. You are clearly outnumbered. You have no allies to turn to, as you're not sure who's going to be your friend yet, or at least that's how you feel inside. And it's the first day. And naturally, you want to, you know, have a good impression both on the boss and your fellow workers, and, you know, show that you can carry the load. Well, anxiety builds as you realize that everyone in this new environment seems to speak a foreign language. Nothing quite makes sense to you, yet there you are, day one, overwhelmed and surrounded. What can you do? What do you do to handle those awkward moments in that life throws at you? Now, they come in different shades for all of us. Sometimes circumstances are extreme, other times they're just different. How do you prepare yourself to be victorious in that strange land? Perhaps you find yourself on the other side of the world, all alone in a hotel where people around you are actually speaking a foreign language, like I did on a mission trip to Kenya. Well, hey, fear and anxiety hit us all at times. Of course, I know full well in a congregation of this side that some of you wouldn't even let yourselves get into that situation. Am I right? Yeah. All alone in a foreign land. When was the last time you did that? But it was supper time. And frankly, I was hungry. It was already dark, and I heard the stories about the carjacking and how dangerous Nairobi can really be after dark. I was forewarned to be hypervigilant. I heard that being out at night as a pale-skinned brother made me a particularly easy target. And yet here I was hungry. Do I cower in my hotel room? Well, frankly, I looked for a room service menu, but at $20 a night, this hotel that my son-in-law picked for me, yeah, it didn't even have a restaurant, never mind room service. However, he did say he would be right back. And in Kenya time, right back can mean a lot of things. And we would go for dinner once he got back. Well, after about 45 minutes of just waiting there in my room with, you know, the anxiety building within me, first night in a new culture, I knew I had to take a step of faith. So I unlocked the door and I went down to the lobby to see if, you know, Jimmy was there waiting for me. Nope, no Jimmy. Just a small lobby full of black folk speaking Swahili, and unlike an hour ago when I arrived, there was now an armed guard at the entrance. No, this wasn't a prison. It's a hotel, even if it had bars on the windows and made it feel a little bit more like a prison than, you know, a Holiday Inn. The dude at the door was wearing a uniform and was packing something on his belt. Yet as I walked towards the door, the guard swung it wide open for me. You know, just ready for me to pass through. Well, I guess he had a multifunction position, right? Not wanting to show fear. After all, I'm a man. I marched straight past him into the street, and I was immediately swarmed by 10 black dudes offering me a ride and all sorts of other things, all in Swahili. I had no idea what they were saying. Oh, okay, so now what? Immediately, what do I do came to mind. Well, I looked up the street and back down and looked around the other way, hoping to see my son-in-law, and not seeing him, well, I turned on my heels and walked right back into that hotel, and hoping that door would swing open like it had before, and when it did, I marched straight back up to my room and locked myself in. And then I laughed. Some world traveler. What a man. I didn't even make it next door to get the food. Fear had again gripped me. But determined to not let fear totally win, after a few more minutes, I went back down to the lobby and to the front desk, and the lady there said she had called Jimmy and he was on his way over. And very shortly thereafter, he arrived and we went next door for dinner. You know, it's comical to me as I look back on it now. But at the time, it was quite overwhelming. And I knew that after supper, Jimmy would head his own direction and I would be left in that hotel all alone in that strange land. Well, when morning came, I knew that I was on my own until Jimmy picked me up and the others from our team would arrive at the airport. Determined not to let fear and anxiety rob me of the joy of my journey or paralyze me into remaining in that hotel room, I took another step of faith and I decided to go for a prayer walk and to check out all my surroundings. So I went down those stairs again, and I got to the door, and I noticed that the night guard was missing from his post. So I opened the door for myself, and out I went. And yep, 10 or so guys immediately mobbed me, wanting to sell me various things or take me to my destination in their cabs. But I decided just to walk. I walked a few miles in a square pattern around the city of Nairobi, and I looked for various landmarks so I would find my way back, and I confronted that fear head on. Trusting the Lord hadn't brought me halfway around the world to sit in a hotel room. The Lord and I walked and talked as good friends do, and he pointed out many things in the city of Nairobi for me that would become key in my preaching throughout the country. Yeah. And after a while, my phone rang, and there's Jimmy announcing his return with the rest of our team. Well, today we continue in a summer of psalms with Psalm 3. It is a psalm of David. We'll follow this psalm next week, actually, with Psalm 4. Imagine that. As these two psalms are actually a really good natural set together. Psalm 3 is for mornings of anxiety, and Psalm 4 for evenings when circumstances in life just simply overwhelm you. Let's see how David dealt with it. So if you have your Bibles with you, I encourage you to turn to Psalm 3. And of course, it'll be up on there if you can read that fine print. Psalm 3. O Lord, how many are my foes? How many rise up against me? Many are saying of me, God will not deliver him. Selah. But you are a shield around me, O Lord. You bestow glory on me and lift up my head. To the Lord I cry aloud, and he answers me from his holy hill, Selah. I lie down and sleep. I wake up again because the Lord sustains me. I will not fear tens of thousands drawn up against me on every side. Arise, O Lord, deliver me, O my God. Strike all my enemies on the jaw. Break the teeth of the wicked. From the Lord comes deliverance. May your blessing be upon your people. Selah. Well, this psalm, like many of them in our modern translations, begins with a scribe's note that kind of describes who and when and which was the author of it. And of course, in this one, it says it's a psalm of David when he fled from his son Absalom. Some versions leave out this for some reason. Yet early Hebraic texts and the later Greek texts keep this important detail. It's important because it gives us genuine insight as to both who and what the author's circumstances were when he was inspired to write this. And so here we find David, the man who, as a mere youth, took down Goliath, who later slew his tens of thousands, the warrior king. For more than 30 years of his life, and he is actually overwhelmed by the circumstances that he finds himself in. The circumstances are his son Absalom has chosen to usurp David's authority and take over David's kingdom. We find the account of this in 2 Samuel 16 and 17. Absalom, as you'll remember, is David's notorious son who raped his sister. This guy is sneaky and conniving and just plain bad news from very early in life, but he is still the son of the king. Even though Absalom did such despicable things, his father graciously kept him alive and well cared for because, frankly, he's his son. Though David did ground him for life. You can read about it in that chapter. To pay back David's benevolence, Absalom begins by swaying the people's opinion on the road that leads to the palace. He was trying to help them to decide who really should be king. After 4 years of conning the people of Israel into believing that they would be better off with him as king, Absalom then persuades David, completely under false pretenses, to unground him so he can go down to Hebron. And David, hoping Absalom has learned his lesson finally and has a change of heart, bids him go in peace. But peace was the furthest thing from Absalom's mind. Absalom wanted the throne and would do whatever it took to get it. He was a man driven by evil, and so much so that even prominent friends of King David, who were invited to accompany Absalom, would unbeknownst to them help Absalom usurp the authority they had sworn to uphold. And so by mid-chapter 15, voices started crying out, "Long live King Absalom!" And as verse 12 says, the conspiracy gained strength and Absalom's following kept on increasing. It didn't take long before news of this rebellion actually reached David's ears. The word on the streets was, "The hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom." And immediately David left the city with many in tow, fearing that Absalom would do to him and the good folks of Jerusalem. Now, some of those folks were fiercely loyal, and others, well, they were just hoping to avoid Absalom's sword, and they kind of went along with this throng out of the city. It was at this point in the narrative that David writes this psalm. Think about that for a moment. Can you even imagine it? While he is on the run, and the people around him were taunting him, predicting a disastrous end, David takes time to write out this psalm. Why on earth would he do that? Doesn't he truly grasp the dire situation that he's in? Well, apparently he does, according to verse 1, right? "Oh Lord, how my adversaries have increased. Many are rising up against me." The threats, they were real. The situation, it was not imagined. Yet David did not simply stand his ground and say, "Come on, bring it on. I've killed my tens of thousands. You're next." No. He knew more was at stake than just his position in life. And isn't it interesting that as he cries out to God, immediately the enemy taunts him with, "Many are they who say of me, there is no help for him in God." Selah. The spiritual warfare begins. Have you experienced this? I mean, in those circumstances that overwhelm you, have you noticed that the enemy of your souls wants you to believe that, you know, God has left you? You need to fend for yourself. You might even tell yourself that you got yourself into this mess. Now you'll have to get yourself out of it because, you know, God helps those who help themselves. You know for sure that that is not in the Bible, right? What they are insinuating is that there is no help from God because he doesn't care about you or this situation that you're in. So you better roll over and die. Of all the conjunctions and prepositions we use in the course of written and spoken communication, the one that seems to have the greatest significance is the little word, but. And unlike and, which, you know, gives us a little bit more information, but does all of that and more. It always suggests the contrary opinion and changes the intended impact of what it precedes. Or pardon me, what precedes it. Well, what follows the but is of great importance in this psalm. I would encourage you just to circle that but. But you, O Lord, are a shield for me, my glory, the one who lifts up my head. Even if everyone in David's kingdom told him God was not going to help him, David knew otherwise. They said, God can't or won't help you, but you, Lord, are a shield around me. You will never leave me nor forsake me. Even if my circumstances overwhelm me, even if the enemy presses in hard and it seems all is lost, you, Lord, are the one who shields me and lifts up my head. And then David does what you and I need to do in those times when the future looks scary or uncertain. We need to remember that the God of our yesterday is the same today, tomorrow, and yes, forever. The enemy wanted David to believe God wasn't going to listen to the likes of him. Yeah. A mere man. Why would God listen to him? The enemy loves to whisper, you know, God has more important things to do than listen to you. More important things to do than to come to your rescue. The enemy of your soul loves to raise doubt and fear in your mind. But David remembers the times when, as he put it, I cried to the Lord with my voice, and he heard me from his holy hill. God had heard in the past, and he will hear again that day. As far as David was concerned, he believed that nothing had changed with God, and now he was so sure of this. But how? How was he so sure of it? Well, David basically said in verse 5, I'm still here, aren't I? If God wanted me gone, then I wouldn't have woke up this morning. Simple as that. So long as I keep laying down and waking up, there is still hope because the Lord sustains me. He is my shield. He is my sustenance. So I can even sleep with danger so imminent. When Saul chased David, determined to kill him, God sustained him on the run through both extraordinary and, frankly, even ordinary means. Eventually, David's enemy was overcome. And David was given that very kingdom because God decreed that David would be king. Now, during the chase, I'm sure David must have wondered if the prophetic word and the oil that anointed him king were misguided words and the actions of a deranged prophet, but God stood true to his word. And David could look back now in the midst of this storm in life. And he could actually sleep soundly in God's ability. Well, God was his shield and defender. David's son would later write in Proverbs 19, verse 23, "The fear of the Lord leads to life. Then one rests content, untouched by trouble." The God who delivered him from Saul was the God that sustained him through the night. Remember when Saul came into the very cave where David was hiding? And all of a sudden, you know, there he is. And all his armies are right outside the door. David had a history with the author of his story. That's how he could say, "I will not be afraid of tens of thousands of people who, you know, have set themselves against me all around." He had a history with that God. But that doesn't mean that David would just sit back reflecting on his glorious past and, you know, "Let's come with me, you know. I don't need to do anything because, you know." The present danger was just as urgent, and so it needed just as urgent of a prayer. And there we find in verse 7, "Arise, O Lord, save me, O my God, for you have struck all my enemies on the cheekbone. You have broken the teeth of the ungodly." Well, various commentators are divided on whether David is actually praying to God for a noticeable deliverance from his enemies, or remembering what happened the last time an arrogant fool tried to mess with God's anointed. If he's praying for God's deliverance, we would call this prayer an imprecatory prayer. David wants the full weight of God's wrath to fall upon his enemies, and the shattered jawbone that even a gifted dental surgeon would have troubles to restore. I suspect, though, that this is not David's request of God for his son, Absalom, but rather a remembrance of God's deliverance. Why I suspect that is not the case comes from both his open concern for his son's safety. David orders that no one is to kill him. And David genuinely mourns upon the news of his son's death. In 2 Samuel 18:5, we read, "The king commanded Joab and Abishai and Ittai, 'Be gentle with the young man Absalom for my sake.' And all the troops heard the king giving orders concerning Absalom to each of the commanders." Did David mean, you know, gently break Absalom's jaw, carefully shattering his teeth? Yeah. Well, if he did, that's not how those troops heard it, right? For it was when they came across Absalom swinging in a tree, they merely reported back to Joab, one of David's mighty warriors, their discovery. They refused to lay a hand on Absalom. He told Joab, "I just saw Absalom hanging in an oak tree." Joab said to the man who told him this, "What? You saw him? Why didn't you strike him to the ground right there? Then I would have given you 10 shekels of silver and a warrior's belt." But the man replied, Even if 1,000 shekels were weighed out into my hands, I would not lift my hand against the king's son. In our hearing, the king commanded you and Abishai and Ittai, protect the young man Absalom for my sake. And if I had put my life in jeopardy, and frankly, nothing is hidden from the king, you would have kept your distance from me. There's a smart soldier. Joab was not so concerned about the king's command. He ran some javelins through Absalom and then told his men to kill him and bury him. When the deed was done, he sent a Cushite to run and to tell the news to David. And Ahazamaz, I think that's how you can say that, also wanted to run and tell the news. And he was actually faster than the first guy that was sent. And when he got close to David, we read, Ahimaaz called out to the king, all is well. He bowed down before the king with his face to the ground and said, praise be to the Lord your God. He has delivered up the men who lifted their hands against the Lord my king. Notice the first words out of David's mouth. The king asked, is the young man Absalom safe? Ahimaaz answered, I saw great confusion just as Joab was about to send the king's servant and me, your servant, but I don't know what it was. I think he knew from David's question not to be the bearer of bad news. You know what I mean? The king said, stand aside and wait here. And so he stepped aside and he stood there. Then the Cushite arrived and said, my lord the king, hear the good news. The Lord has delivered you today from those who rose up against you. The king asked the same question of the Cushite. Is the young man Absalom safe? The Cushite replied, may the enemies of my lord the king and all who rise up to harm you be like that young man. Well, we read that the king was shaken. He went up to the room over the gateway and he wept. As he went, he said, oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, if only I had died instead of you. Oh, Absalom, my son, my son. So getting back to David's prayer in Psalm 3, verse 7, it seems entirely unreasonable to think that David would pray for God's wrath upon his son. Entirely unreasonable, in my humble opinion. I believe he was remembering the outcome of God's deliverance, knowing that his current circumstances were entirely in God's control. And no army mustered against God's anointed would succeed if God be against it. Well, David writes in verse 8, from the Lord comes deliverance. May your blessing be upon your people, Selah. Or as the New King James Version puts it, salvation belongs to the Lord. Your blessing is upon your people, Selah. David moved from a state of shock that we found in verse 1 to renewed faith in the Lord in verse 7. He does this by starting with prayer, then remembering God's character and dealings with him throughout his life, and praying for the Lord's deliverance in this time of need. So as you go through times of trials in your life, try what David recorded here. Cry out to God. Listen to what the people are saying around you. But, remember who it was that brought you salvation. And sleep soundly, knowing that he will never leave you nor forsake you. No matter what man or circumstances may throw your way. Now, if you don't know the Lord that David speaks of, there's a but there. But now you can. You can begin with the prayer with Lord Jesus, I need you to come. I need your salvation. And as you get to know the Lord, you'll find that he is able to do exceedingly abundantly above all that you ask or even imagine, including deliverance from anxiety you're currently facing. Amen.